Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Constantly making trips to Home Depot? Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you for every shopping trip. Earn free gift cards for shopping. Download the Drop app now and use code DROP33 to get $5 in points.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, time to go into that old vault. And this is going to be an episode from July 28th, 2016, that you actually did with our old friend Christian Sager.
Yeah, this episode gets into the topic of amusia and some related conditions in which an individual does not get music. And I don't mean in the sense that, like, you know, they just don't get funk or they don't get this particular genre.
Don't understand why everybody likes Eric Clapton's solo career.
Right, but yeah, the idea that music could just not be connecting with certain brains the way that it does with the rest of us.
That sounds very interesting. I'm intrigued. Maybe I'll give it a listen.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and dive into minds of musical emptiness.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And my name is Christian Sager. Hey, Robert, have you ever met a person who doesn't like music?
I do not think I've ever met anyone who just across the board doesn't like music. I've certainly met plenty of people who seem to dislike music in certain scenarios.
Yeah.
Because I'm the kind of type of
like
person
types of music, you mean?
Well, right? Types of music, but also music in certain situations. Like, I've certainly known people who don't like music while driving. I'm of the mindset I want music on all the time, just about. Music of my own choosing, but music.
I know a lot of our colleagues have difficulty writing while there's music on. I don't have that problem, although I do like sort of cultivate playlists of stuff that helps me to write, you know, mostly instrumental stuff, but
yeah,
sometimes there's certain music that I can listen to that has vocals that I can listen to while writing. But yeah, so, you know, I know, like you, like I've known like various sort of iterations of people who can't listen to music during certain times. I've only met like one or two people in my life who just don't, they literally say, I don't like music.
And that's so alien, so difficult for us to comprehend, because it's like hearing someone say, oh, I don't like food. I don't like drinking liquids.
It almost seems inhuman in a way. And I think like when you hear that, at least in my experience, people will kind of think like, oh, that's the trait of a psychopath, right? But it's not. It's actually not. We've talked about psychopaths on the show, and that hasn't come up as one of the symptoms. But also, as we're going to talk about today, this is a real brain condition.
Yeah, at least a couple of different conditions we're going to discuss. Yeah. And I think they both serve to remind us just how tenuous our sensory experience of the world really is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, think about you and me, right? Like, the audience probably knows, if they don't already, that you are really into electronic music, and you cover it for Stuff to Blow Your Mind. I'd say weekly, right?
You're writing about it. I try to, yeah.
Yeah, and I, as many people have heard on other episodes, grew up in the punk and metal scene and still listen to a lot of that stuff, which a lot of people find unlistenable and dissonant, including, mm-hmm. you know, my wife. And I'm okay with that, but it's interesting because dissonance plays into these diseases as well.
Well, here's a quick question for you, and I think this helps to sort of, this helps a lot of us try and comprehend what some of these conditions are like.
Yeah.
Like, what's a type of music that you just really don't get, that you just, you can't really listen to, you don't understand, and you're just willing to say, yeah, that is not for me?
Usually, like, NPR-style jazz. I don't want to just say jazz in general, because there's plenty of stuff that's being done in that area that's interesting and I like. Mm-hmm. But, like, that kind of, like, background elevator music jazz, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that drives me crazy. It's like fingers on a chalkboard.
For me, it's, I have to say, jazz as well. And part of this could be, I mean, the view, I guess, is that jazz takes some getting used to. You have to immerse yourself in it. And I like some jazz, and I like jazzy elements in some of the music I listen to from time to time, but it's that jazzy jazz, that spacey jazz, that completely unhinged jazz that just kind of gives me the shakes sometimes.
It's making me think of this joke on Parks and Rec. I don't know if you remember this, but their local NPR station, they had a show and they would say, jazz plus jazz equals jazz.
Yeah.
So yeah, whenever I hear something like that, I'm like, nope, turn the channel.
I often think about it that it's maybe like a strong alcoholic property, you know, some sort of strong liqueur that you would never drink on its own, but you would use in a recipe, or you would certainly use in a mixed drink. So I often think, well, that is the strong, undiluted stuff. That is not for me.
Yeah, but you can put a shot of it, or like, I don't drink clearly, so a shot's a lot, but you know, a little bit. It's like adding grenadine to your soda or something like that, to a drink, and giving a little flavor.
Well, like, punk is one of those things. I think about this sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like pure punk. It's not my scene. It's not what I dig. But I've certainly loved groups that have elements of punk in their sound.
Yeah.
That either come out of punk or find some of their musical genre to combine it with. Like, the Pogues come to mind. You
yeah,
know?
Sure.
Like a little bit of Irish music, a little bit of punk music. It's really, I would be hard pressed to want to listen to Irish or punk music on their own, but when these two come together, then I've always enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. Even like having spent many a year in basements watching just like crusty punk bands just hammering out 4-chord songs, I can understand where you're coming from. And that sort of has led to like what a lot of our, I guess, like popular alternative music is nowadays, right? It's sort of like a fusion of punk and jazz, or punk and metal, or Joe and I were just talking the other night about ska, like 90s ska, and how that was sort of something like that. Yeah. Well, okay, enough about our musical interests, but so clearly we're human beings who love music. We've got opinions about music. We like to talk about it. We like to listen to it. We go to shows. But there's people out there who don't, and it's not just because, you know, they don't go to things like that, or they're just not. It's because there's literally something going on in their brain that makes it so that they're incapable of enjoying music.
Right. Something's wired differently. Some systems are online in a slightly different array. And we will get into these in a moment. But before we do, we thought it'd be helpful to just go ahead and give a nice overview of the cognitive experience of music.
Yeah.
Just basically what's going on when we process it. So music is, of course, a deep part of our cognitive architecture. It changes our mood. It heightens our emotions. It summons and banishes memories. It affects the manner in which we perceive time, even. We can actually use it to treat illnesses of the mind and body. So it's powerful stuff. It's potent stuff.
Yeah. That's not even just with human beings. There's been research done on plants, that music affects plants.
So we're talking about some serious magic here.
Yep.
There are parts of the brain that respond to music that don't respond to language. There are separate parts of the brain that respond to the melody of language, different from the parts of the brain that respond to the melody of music. There are parts of the brain that deal with movement, attention, planning, and memory, and these all respond to music, even though they don't have anything to do with the actual auditory process. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, and we don't fully understand it yet. I mean, I would say this research, well, you know, we'll talk about it later, but really only in the last century have we even been aware of this as a medical condition, but only in maybe the last 20 or 30 years has there been like real deep research into what this means.
Yeah, and certainly there's a lot of wonderful research out there about mm-hmm. our relationship with music, and we can't cover it all here, but just a couple of, I think, illuminating studies to touch on here. In recent years, we found that you can look to the brain via fMRI, and specifically you can look at brain activity in the nucleus accumbens. This is involved in the formation of expectations.
Okay.
And we can actually tell if a person is enjoying the music they're listening to by looking at brain activity in this region. Mm. If it's meeting their musical expectations and matching up with the stored templates of what you've heard before, then you see stuff light up.
Yeah. I could absolutely believe that given my experience with music.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're just like I don't know, like here's an example. Like I walk around sometimes and I'll just have like my entire music library on shuffle on my phone or something uh-huh. like that. Like one like really great song from my high school days will like pop up. And it's like I can feel like whatever those lights are that are going on in right. my brain just activate, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The expectation plays such an interesting role in our experience of music because on one hand, There's something that happens when a melody or a tune or the lyrics take you to that place you're expecting it to go.
Yeah.
But then also when it goes to a slightly different place where it kind of you think it's going to turn left and it turns right.
Yeah.
Like that animates yeah. you as well. It's almost like narrative without words, really.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to put it. I'll just do a little bit of subjective experience here to throw in here.
Okay.
I'm not like personally a big fan of The Cure, but a friend of mine is, and if he's listening, Herc, this is your story. So The Cure just played in Atlanta recently, like mm-hmm. I think like 2 weeks ago. Did you know about this?
Oh yeah. I have some friends who are really
They went to this show.
Yeah.
So the way that he told me was that like, apparently this tour was like, you know, they were going to be playing all their greatest hits or whatever, but that it was sort of like a different arrangement of the musical instruments. So mm-hmm. he was really excited because he's like, well, I'm going to hear these songs that I love, and it's going to be played by the guys who wrote them, but they're going to be playing them in very different ways than I'm used to, and that's a wholly new experience.
Oh,
know?
Yeah. I've had that experience with, Tool has been where
that seems like the kind of band that would do something like that.
Yeah, yeah, they'll play with the intro on something, and so the live version at first you're not sure what it's going to be, but then then you realize, oh, it's this track, it's that track, whatever the particular track may be, and there's this, you know, a physical experience of excitement
totally.
That rolls through you.
When I was, you know, still involved in the music scene and just going to a lot of shows, the thing that was always the most impressive to me and that just showed like a real class act professional touring band was when they could play an entire set without stopping.
Mm-hmm.
Like they would just start and their songs, they had figured out ways to weave their songs in and out of one another. So they would just play like a really tight 30, 40 minute set and then boom, they were done, got off on stage. And that is the kind of thing that just floors you. It's just like, you don't have time to stop and breathe and kind of mm-hmm. judge them for other factors, like whatever they're wearing or what they say in between songs or something. You're just like bombarded.
Well, that's one of the reasons that I've been so into DJ mixes over the years.
Oh, yeah,
It's not quite the same as a band performing their entire set without stop, but the idea that you can take various musical elements and a talented DJ can create a seamless tapestry of sound.
Yeah.
I love that. And certainly you get those surprises, those expectations met or skewed throughout that sonic narrative as well.
So, all right, we're clearly establishing that we're music nerds. We love music, mm-hmm. and whatever parts of the brain that don't work for some of these people, they're lighting up like fireworks for us.
Now, another key point, though, is certainly you've been to a concert or performance.
Yeah.
And you've been experiencing the music, and maybe you've seen somebody that like clearly their significant other drugged them here and they're not enjoying it, or they got a free ticket.
When you said drugged them, I thought you literally gave them drugs so that they would just sit put. But yeah.
That's possible depending on the
because I've
the
seen
venue.
Both.
Yeah. So you've seen people that are not into it or they're experiencing it for the first time, or maybe you don't feel like they could possibly be enjoying the music on the same level as you are.
Yeah, possibly. And certainly, like, I have to applaud my wife again. Like, she's indulged me by, you know, sometimes I can't get a friend to go with me to a particular kind of thing. And she's like, all right, you know, I'll go with you. You know, we'll go see Converge and High on Fire. And she's just sitting there, like, shaking her head while I'm, like, really into it, you know?
Yeah.
I get that. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because despite all of our varied musical taste and our varying levels of engagement with particular types of music, particular performances, the brain experiences that we have are actually pretty consistent among most people.
Yeah.
There was a 2013 study published in the European Journal of Neuroscience, and they found that if two people listened to the same track, one an experienced fan of the music and another not, the other one just like a newcomer.
Okay.
This has been dragged in there by their spouse.
Yeah, right.
You're still going to see the same synchronization in several key brain areas and similar brain activity.
Okay.
So as much as you might like to think you're experiencing your favorite band at an entirely different cognitive level than the dumb guy next to you with the glowies on his fingers, that doesn't seem to be quite the case. We're still engaging like the same networks.
I wonder if this is similar to like research that's been done on depression and anxiety, in that like the more you listen to the songs over and over again, right? Like it's like writing over the same pathway of the brain over and over and over again. So it makes it easier for that experience to happen. It's happening in the same way for everybody, but it's just kind of going through the brain. I don't know how to describe this other than with like road metaphors, right? Like it's like going down the same road, but it's just like going down faster for us or something.
Well, that plays into expectation, right?
Yeah.
Where the road is going to turn, where it's going to split, et cetera.
Yeah. Interesting. Huh. I wonder if anybody's done research on that. Like the experience of having music encoded to the brain as being similar to the sort of expectations that encode anxiety into people.
Huh. Yeah, I will have to follow up on that because I know there have been a number of studies that have looked into, you know, the potential therapeutic aspects of music, as well as the role of music in various emotional states. So.
Yeah, and you think about it, like some of the emotional states that are created by listening to music have very similar symptoms to anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well, all right, maybe that's a future episode. We'll have to dig deep for that one. But let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about the condition of amusia or tone deafness.
Are you spending a fortune while shopping on Amazon? What if I said you can earn cash back while you shop? Introducing Drop, the ultimate rewards app. Whether it's fashion, electronics, or groceries, you can earn free gift cards just by shopping online or in-store at tons of your favorite brands. Download the Drop app now and start earning while you shop. Plus, for a limited time, use code DROP11 to get $5 in points instantly.
Father's Day is coming, a day we celebrate the guy who's always there for us. To crack a dad joke. Well, you know what's not a dad joke? Getting $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker with the purchase of his favorite cocktail capsule pack. $50 off. No dad joke. See, this is a dad joke. I lost my glasses today, and guess who I bumped into? Everyone. But the Bartesian Cocktail Maker? It's no joke. Each cocktail capsule contains real fruit juices and all-natural bitters, so dad can make over 60 premium cocktails he loves. Sidecars, old fashions, gimlets, all with the push of a button. So, for the dad who loves a cocktail with friends and a good joke from time to time, get the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. $50 off now until Father's Day. Visit bartesian.com/father to get 50 off the best premium cocktail maker for dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
All right, we're back. So this first one, tone deafness, amusia, I feel like this is going to be the one where we're going to see far more listeners who can share experiences with this.
Yeah,
and certainly
probably.
We've probably all encountered people with varying levels of tone deafness over the years.
Yeah, and it seems like tone deafness has variations on it, like extremes or, you know, some people have it to less an extent than others. The term congenital amusia is what we use to denote tone deafness that you're born with. It's been described in medical literature for more than a century, and it manifests basically as a severe deficiency in processing pitch variations. Now, this extends to impairments in musical memory and recognition as well as what we traditionally think of as tone deafness is like bad singing or the inability to tap in time with music, right? Everybody right now is probably thinking of like the person who, I don't know, was in choir or something
yeah,
like that.
Can't
and they
hold
just
a tune.
Couldn't
yeah.
hit the notes. Yeah. Some literature also refers to amusia as dysmelodia or dysmusia, but the term amusia is generally agreed to be preferable because it acknowledges the possibility that there exist as many forms of congenital amusias as there are forms of acquired amusias. And what I mean by that is accidental brain damage. So you can hurt yourself in a variety of ways that will also produce this effect. Now, to clarify, congenital means present from birth, but it is possible to acquire amusia through brain damage in life. The very first study that looked at this was done in 1878 by a guy named Grant Allen, and he was investigating a 30-year-old man with a neurological lesion that gave him this, as he referred to it then, severe musical handicap. And maybe some of you out there are wondering right now, like, I can relate to this. Is this me? Well, it could be. A recent study found that out of 100 people who self-declared themselves as having a handicap for music, only 22, so 22%, actually exhibited the traits of amusia after they were tested with a formal questionnaire. And the way that this questionnaire worked, it tested your aptitude for scale, interval, and contour information, as well as melodic organization dimension, rhythm and meter, and temporal organization dimension. They also tested memory recognition ability connected to music. Now, those who are tone deaf are generally unable to hear the differences in pitch and tone that the rest of us hear. We joke about this, right? You know, that there's always like, and I imagine with like movies like Pitch Perfect or TV shows like Glee, like there must be tons of jokes about tone deafness.
Oh, yeah. It seems like every long-running show ever has had at least an episode where, oh, it's the person who can't sing, but they don't realize they can't sing.
Yeah, so it's a common enough of a thing that it shows up in some pop culture narrative and we all recognize it. We use the phrase really to describe people who don't understand simple communication strategies too, right? Like, like even outside of it, we've turned it into this metaphor for like, oh, well, he's tone deaf. So that's why he doesn't understand what we're talking about here. It's not even, we're using it on a level beyond like its actual medical application, right? At its most extreme though, people who are tone deaf are unable to even perceive music the same way that the rest of us do. And it comes down to an actual difference in their brain structure. And it's different from those like, you know, Robert and myself for whom music comes naturally. Okay. It's actually defined as a learning disability. There's a team from the University of Montreal who have first published an empirical study on it, and that's their delineation. So, for instance, most children, and I didn't realize this, but this is probably a common experience for you. Most children learn to sing at the same time that they're learning to speak, right? So they're like kind of like singing words. Like I was babysitting a friend of ours, 4-year-old, the other night, and he was singing constantly, but then he would just kind of talk to himself too.
Oh, yeah, that's my experience with my son, Bastion, is there's a lot of talking at this point. He's 4. But there's also a lot of singing. He'll just burst into song about the silliest things to the point where we're just like, all right, you can't sing about butter anymore. Just just eat. Don't play with the butter and don't sing about the butter. For God's
sake. Just consume the butter. Well, that sounds like he is not tone deaf because tone deaf children don't do this singing thing when they're younger. And this is where this woman seems to be like the expert on this. Like every study I was looking at, she was somehow involved in. Her name's Isabel Peretz, and that's when she gave it the official disorder congenital amusia. It's innate in these people's brain, the lack of musical perception, and it's also hereditary. They found that congenital amusia is genetically transmitted. 39% of the people who have first-degree relatives with this cognitive disorder also have it. However, if you look at control groups, only 3% have it in control group families. However, congenital amusia doesn't seem to result from any particular family environment. It's not like, I don't know, you can somehow connect it to like alcoholics or something like that, right? Like there doesn't seem to be an environmental source that's causing this. It seems to be genetic. Remember though, genes don't specify cognitive function. They actually influence brain development. So the next step that these researchers are looking at is let's identify the genes that relate to these neuroanatomical anomalies that are found in the brains of people who have amusia. Now, interestingly, that 3% control group almost lines up exactly with what they found to be the percentage of people in the population who have it. 4% seems to be the number of people in the general population who are amusiac. They grow up with normal exposure to music and are otherwise capable of doing everything else everybody else does. They're intelligent, they're educated. This only affects their ability to recognize pitch in music. And it doesn't apply to language. This is the really fascinating part, right? Amusiacs can process speech as well as environmental sounds like, I don't know, like an animal's cry or something, right? Or voices. They can understand all of that. They can even understand the pitch changes in different languages. Like, you know a little Chinese. I spent some time in China. You know how important pitch is to the difference in words. They're fine with that. But it's only with the music that they have this pitch problem.
Well, it reminds me of some of the bits we discussed earlier about how our brains process music and the idea that your brain is processing it separately from the music itself based on all of these other factors. So I guess it stands to reason someone with even, you know, fairly significant amusia here could still listen to, say, a track with some really engaging lyrics, of course.
Yeah.
And they're going to get some sort of lyrical experience out of it.
They might, yeah.
And maybe even something that is, I'm thinking of some of the least musical music that I like, some of the more noise-oriented stuff. Like, maybe they could listen to that and appreciate that on some level that is not as tied to the music but still somehow tied to a sonic experience of the thing.
We are going to get back to that, yeah. There's a way that dissonance in particular plays into both a regular music listening experience and a music listening experience. But there's actually some amusiacs that are recorded that are fluent in several languages. So this doesn't at all affect their other communicative abilities. And the way that they figured this out was they used these tests that were originally designed to assess the presence and specificity of musical disorders in patients with brain damage. And the big one seems to be the difficulty in detecting pitch-related changes, right? Mm-hmm. Especially when that extends into dissonance, which amusical subjects have little sensitivity to. So that's interesting, right? So people who love music, when you create music that has dissonance in it, when tones are playing over one another, uh-huh. that don't match up the right way and it just sounds like kind of white noise, some people hate that, right? Like I dated a girl once who I remember putting on a record in a car and she just said, turn this off. It just sounds like insects.
Yeah.
And she wasn't wrong, but she probably wasn't into music because they have very little sensitivity to dissonance.
Okay. So one with this condition could very well be an exclusive fan of, say, like Nurse with Wound or early Einstein's Into Neubauten. Like throw a xylophone down a hallway sort of music.
That's what I'm kind of wondering is if like these experimental noise fans that are just super into it and that's all they listen to, I wonder if you could have a musia and not even know it because that's sort of your genre of choice. It doesn't appear, unfortunately, to be something that can be, quote-unquote, fixed either. Peretz's team has tried teaching kids with amusia to like music, actually. They gave them MP3 players, and they said, listen to this for 30 minutes a day. Not only did the kids fail to improve on their tests, but how poorly they scored on the tests correlated to how much they reported listening to the music. So the next steps to see if there's any kind of way to reverse this seem to be some kind of remediation training programs that might improve pitch perception and memory. At the very least, this will help us understand the neurological basis for this so that we can use it to diagnose other learning disorders too. So what's going on in the brain here, right? Like let's zoom in, take a look at the brain, and figure out what exactly the deal is. Well, there's a study by a team in France, and they used MEG scanners to figure this out. Amusic people's brains stemmed from delayed or impaired functioning in their frontal and auditory cortex. They also had physical abnormalities in those areas of the brain with more gray matter and less white matter than usual. Now, this is something that's come up on the show a couple times when we're talking about everything from brain disorders to drug usage, right? Yeah. Like that white-gray matter balance seems to be pretty important. Again, people with amusia, they don't enjoy music, but they're capable of enjoying all the other pleasures that the rest of us are, right? It's not like they're dead inside.
Right. It's just this one area, and arguably an area that you know, certainly has nothing to do with their survival or ability to move and enjoy life and partake of our culture. They're just not into the musical aspect of it.
Yeah. I mean, they like food, they like money, they like sex. This has all been tracked in there was a March 6th article in the Journal of Current Biology. Mm-hmm. They looked at this. So, we know it's innate or it's acquired. We know it prevents people from processing music the way they do. There's also another way to look at this, another terminology called specific musical anhedonia. And this is what another study's authors called the inability to experience pleasure from music in general. So if amusia is the like disease, the extreme version where you can't appreciate music at all is this specific musical anhedonia. In their study, they divided 30 people into three even groups, and they were asked to do what they called a music task, where they listened to classical pieces of music and then they rated them. Then they were asked to do a monetary incentive delay task. Basically, this is gambling. And usually, both would induce an emotional reaction in the brain. The researchers analyzed the heart rate of their subjects and how much they perspired. Now, some were, quote, emotionally oblivious to music, but they could tell what they were supposed to be feeling. So they heard the stuff. They knew they were supposed to be having some kind of feeling, but their brain wasn't registering it. Their brain registered, okay, there's some reward system in place. When they were playing around with the money and gambling, that was lighting up, but not when they were listening to music.
Hmm.
So I'm wondering, this is just me here, and maybe I'm way off, but do you think amusia can also affect a person's timing and tapping in terms of like fine motor control? Because I'm thinking, like, if you can't tap out a beat along to a song, would that affect your fine motor control in terms of like trying to find, I don't know, I'm thinking about like platform video games where you're trying to like jump from one thing to another at just the exact right time.
Sort of like the old school platformers where they were just insanely difficult and you essentially had to know like the exact beats to hit, the exact
there's
key
a rhythm
to
that, right? And I'm wondering if that affects them as well, or like,
or a Simon game comes to mind.
Oh yeah, that would be a perfect example. Yeah like they'd just be unable to do Simon. I'm curious about that.
Again, it comes down to like, you know, small loss, I guess.
Well,
if you can't play
yeah,
Simon
wouldn't be a big deal, but I would imagine if the fine motor control extended into other aspects of your life, that might be difficult.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there was a time when, like, the predominant game, video game, was those insane platformers.
Oh, yeah.
And if you were not able to partake of those, I mean, you felt like you were missing out a little bit. Like, I was just always kind of horrible at them.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling a little left out. Like, I had never beat, I don't think I beat any of those old Nintendo games.
Yeah.
And I did feel like, was there something wrong with me that I haven't beat Super Mario Brothers 2?
I can sort of remember that, yeah, because especially like our generation, the way we played, like we all would just huddle around the TV and the console, right, for hours at a time. I remember playing like Mega Man for like 10 hours straight into the middle of the night with my buddies, and we would like switch off, right? But yeah, you would sort of get laughed at if you weren't as like, oh, you can't make that one little jump? Come on, you know?
Thank God they got easier.
Ever tried to tackle a home improvement project without making 10 trips to Home Depot? What if I told you there's a way to earn cash back while you shop? Introducing Drop, the ultimate rewards app. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards by shopping in-store or online at Home Depot and tons of other stores. Download the Drop app today and use code DROP33 to get an instant $5 in points. That's Drop, your go-to for shopping rewards.
Father's Day is coming, a day we celebrate the guy who's always there for us. To crack a dad joke. Well, you know what's not a dad joke? Getting $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker with the purchase of his favorite cocktail capsule pack. $50 off. No dad joke. See, this is a dad joke. I lost my glasses today, and guess who I bumped into? Everyone. But the Bartesian Cocktail Maker, it's no joke. Each cocktail capsule contains real fruit juices and all-natural bitters, so dad can make over 60 premium cocktails he loves. Sidecars, old fashions, gimlets, all with the push of a button. So, for the dad who loves a cocktail with friends and a good joke from time to time, get the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. $50 off now until Father's Day. Visit bartesian.com/father to get 50 off the best premium cocktail maker for dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
A Okay, so Robert, tell us a little bit more about agnosia and how it's related to amusia.
Well, agnosia in Greek means not knowing. And from a broad standpoint, agnosia refers to a number of different neural disorders that in which the subject experiences an inability to process different sensory information. Now, what sort of information? This varies a lot. Some experience an inability to recognize and identify objects or persons or aspects of objects or persons. The sense itself is not defective, however. It's just how you're processing it. So it's not that you can't hear. It's not that you can't see.
Yeah.
It's just there's no memory loss. And it might be limited to a single sense. It might be more than one.
So what I immediately thought of here was Oliver Sacks' famous study, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Which was about a guy who had a brain disorder and literally like couldn't perceive the difference between his wife when he saw her and his hat. And Oliver Sacks was famous for doing all kinds of studies like this. But that seems like maybe a more extreme version of agnosia.
Well, there are a number of different versions of it that have been either officially or unofficially identified.
Okay.
So just a few here. There's finger agnosia. This is an inability to recognize the fingers of the hand.
Oof.
There's a more famous one, and certainly Oliver Sacks studied this one a good bit, and this is prosopagnosia. This is face blindness.
Yep.
So you look at a face. It's not that you can't see. It's not even that you can't see a face. It's not like on that wonderful episode of Hannibal.
Right. Where it's just like a swirly, like blank thing. Right.
It's not that as wonderful as that was visually in that show.
Yeah.
That's not really what face blindness is like.
Yeah.
But still, you can't, you're looking at the face, you're seeing the face, but you can't really identify what's going on.
You can't like put the markers together to identify it as being different from one face or another.
Right. There's also phonagnosia, which is voice blindness.
Mm-hmm.
There's time agnosia, which is an inability to interpret the passaging of time.
Mm.
And there's also semantic agnosia, and this is object blindness. And without being fresh on the details of the hat situation,
yeah,
that seems like that would be the related classification.
Probably, yeah.
And I have to say, and I have to bring this up and be geeky about it since I'm currently reading the latest book in R. Scott Baker's Prince of Nothing series.
Yeah, you have told me about this numerous times, and so has a friend of the show, E.C. Steiner.
Yeah, I look forward to chatting about this latest book with Steiner because it's the title's A Great Ordeal. But throughout the entire series, there's this tragic, undying elder race known as the non-men.
Okay.
So they're like humans, but they're very alien in many respects. They've been around forever. They've had all these traumatic experiences. And there are a few different differences, that, like very notable differences between them and humans. Like, for instance, they're ghastly and pale, kind of ghoulish. Their teeth are all fused together. But the one that I've always found really fascinating was the revelation that they can't see paintings.
Interesting.
They deal almost exclusively with sculpture.
Three-dimensional
representations.
That would definitely work for Steiner since he's working. For those of you who don't know who we're talking about, this is a friend of ours who's actually done work for the show before, mm-hmm. especially for our video series. He's worked with me on comic books before in two-dimensional formats, but he actually sculpted like these huge set pieces that we used for the Monster Science series here. He did this wonderful Cthulhu piece that we have here in the office, and there's the giant Cyclops skull that you can see in the background and a couple of those.
Mm-hmm.
So he's worked with us on the show before.
Yeah, and so maybe he himself is one of the non-men.
He might be, yeah.
But I've seen people interpret this like painting blindness, if you will, as maybe it's something to do with, oh, well, they can't see colors, they have color blindness. But I can't help but wonder if this is if this would be some sort of like painting agnosia.
Okay.
And certainly R. Scott Baker works so many neuroscientific and philosophical ideas into his work.
Yeah.
I would not be surprised at all if that was a partial inspiration for it.
Okay. Yeah, I like that.
But all of these,
extrapolating it outward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all of these conditions, the real ones that we've discussed here, they're examples where, again, the stimuli is entering through your senses, but then something is messed up. The wiring is crossed. There's something in many cases physically damaged in the brain that is permitting the proper processing of that stimuli.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where this enters the musical realm is auditory agnosia. And there are essentially two different versions here. There's classical auditory agnosia, which entails environmental sounds. So this would be like you hear a bird or a car, but you're unable to process exactly what that sound is.
Yep.
And then there is interpretive or receptive agnosia. And this entails music and gets more into this idea of musical agnosia.
I guess like here's a good point for me to probably clarify too, because I have this. I don't know about you, but I have a good bit of tinnitus from all my years going to shows. And even though I wore earplugs, I still hear that whistling at night. And if everything's quiet, I just hear a high-pitched whine all the time. And this isn't that, though, right? Like, that's an actual, like, we actually have an episode of Brain Stuff about that. But that's part of your eardrum being affected and then connecting to your brain. This is totally different. This is just brain.
Right. Now, in some of the cases, and we'll look at a couple of case studies here in a minute, in some of those you do see, like, actual deafness occurring as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, for the most part, we're talking about about not a physical hearing loss.
Yeah.
So examples of this go back at least as far as 1905. I was looking at some articles about this, and they reference a physician only referred to as Bonvincini and another one by the name of Lamy, L-A-M-Y.
Okay.
And both of those encountered individuals who had difficulty with music. So they could, in the first one, the 1905 case, the patient could still process musical information but could no longer recognize well-known tunes.
Hmm.
He could pick out a wrong note in a famous tune, but he couldn't name that tune. And then the 1907 case from Lamy, L-A-M-Y, described a patient who could transcribe his national anthem but didn't know what it was.
That's interesting. Huh. And I'm assuming that given their names, they probably weren't transcribing the American national anthem.
Right. I think these were both, at least the first one was Italian.
Yeah.
I'm not certain about Lamy. Again, I looked to try and find some more information about these individuals.
It's possible that Lemmy from Motorhead did some stuff of his own on
well,
these.
Certainly
but
he...
Those may be lost to time.
All right. So the thing to keep in mind is there's a lot of variety.
Right.
Here's an example, a 2011 case that was reported by Zhang, Kaga, and Hayashi of a 27-year-old woman with long-term severe hydrocephalus. This is abnormal accumulation of cerebrospinal fluid in the brain.
Okay.
And this was due to congenital spina bifida.
Mm.
She gradually lost her hearing, but she experienced, quote, severe difficulty in distinguishing verbal, environmental, and musical instrument sounds. As her hearing left her, she continued to enjoy music, however, and because she could sense the rhythms by simply turning up the music loud enough to feel the vibrations.
Yeah.
And this allowed her to actually summon the memories, the emotional associations that she had made with the music prior to her hearing loss.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
Yeah, I think it's kind of beautiful. I mean, it gets into this idea that we discussed earlier, that the brain is processing music in a few different ways.
Yeah,
and right. If one of those bridges happens to break down, it doesn't mean, you know, the information can't get across.
Yeah. And the vibrations alone are enough to sort of trigger those emotional associations is interesting.
Yeah. And you can also, of course, get into, I don't think they got into it as much in the paper, but, you know, you have instances where you can use hearing aid devices that depend upon like vibrations in the skull as opposed to, straight up, eardrum sensations.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
Now, compare all of this to an earlier case. This was presented in 1996 in the Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience. This was first studied in the 70s, but it was a 40-year-old nurse referred to as CN, who, following a series of surgeries at age 35 to repair cerebral aneurysms in each of her temporal lobes, complained that she was no longer able to pick out the simplest overlearned tune. You know, tunes she should have known just by heart.
Yeah.
So she no longer recognized tunes from her own record collection unless they had audible lyrics.
Okay.
Which is interesting. She could only identify them if the lyrics kicked in.
So this is making me think of people. I listen to a lot of music that has unrecognizable lyrics, mm-hmm. and I'm okay with that. But I know a lot of people who are like, how could you listen to that? You don't know what they're saying. I wonder if that's connected.
I don't know.
Or maybe it's just an aesthetic preference, but...
I often think of in cases like that where you can't quite understand what the vocalist is saying. Yeah. It's like Thom Yorke comes to mind. Certainly some of the music of Tool even or Meshuggah is another act that comes to mind where if I'm not even understanding exactly what's saying or I'm only picking up on certain words, like the voice itself is a musical instrument.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was just mentioning this the other day to a friend of mine about Radiohead, that that's how I think of Thom Yorke, is less as a lyricist and more as like a vocal musical contributor, sort of like how Mike Patton does stuff with his voice in some of his side projects, like Fantomas, where he's not even really saying things, but he's just like using his voice as an instrument.
Yeah, or like certainly we can all listen to music in different languages. We can listen to, say, Mongolian throat singing.
Yeah,
and still and we enjoy get the it. Experience. And can still enjoy it.
Yeah.
So the individual in question here, she had no problem understanding or communicating verbally.
Okay.
But music simply didn't register like it used to.
Wow.
Musical patterns found no purchase in her mind, and this made her a near perfect case of music agnosia.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it sounds like there's an overlap there with amusia. So I wonder if, like, the neurobiologists that are really looking into this deeply, if there's just a terminology overlap here, or if there's some symptoms of agnosia and some symptoms of amusia that separate them out as being totally different.
I think that there is definite overlap here because I have seen in some of the papers we were looking at, they even used them interchangeably or said this is also known as amusia. Though there are plenty of cases, especially in the stuff we covered earlier, where amusia is not describing agnosia and vice versa.
So it sounds like that we need to do a lot more research on this and sort of better identify these categories.
Yeah, I believe the experts in these areas are still trying to get firm ideas of what's going on because certainly agnosia is a rarity compared to the more simpler versions of amusia.
Right. Yeah, you can have amusia and okay, so maybe this is the difference. Amusia is the 4% of the population who are just tone deaf.
Right.
Whereas agnosia or the term that I was using earlier. Let me scroll back into the notes to find it. Specific musical anhedonia.
Mm-hmm.
Those sound like the extreme version of it where you just don't process music at all.
Right. And I think that's I think that's where we see the overlap, in those conditions where we're talking, especially when we're talking about brain injuries, physical trauma to the brain, physical changes to the brain that result in these symptoms. Now, in the treatment of agnosia, the analogy I made earlier about the two bridges, that's ultimately where we see the main treatment or coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
And that is that if one bridge is out, there are other bridges. There are other ways that we consume music, that we take music in. And so we see in various cases where it basically information is just presented in other modalities with that connect to the patient. So it's just a different way of connecting with the music.
It's interesting that you use the term bridges because from what I can tell, the causes that lead to, and these are the physical causes that lead to agnosia, usually are around the occipitotemporal border in the brain of the ventral stream, right? Connecting parts of the brain together, the bridges between that. That gets damaged. And this could be lesions on the parietal or temporal lobes. It can be produced from a head injury or a stroke or infection or carbon monoxide poisoning. It's all kinds of things, right? But these lead to all the kinds of agnosia, not just the auditory ones we're talking about, also visual and tactile. That, you know, we're focusing on auditory today, but that bridge, if that's severed, that's where that sense kind of goes haywire.
Yeah.
All right. So this is what I'm wondering, and this is what I'd like to see more research of, you know, leading us out for the future. What effects do amusia or agnosia have on other behaviors? Like, We've seen, okay, yes, these people understand language still, right? And they're capable of being functional in society and working and being intelligent and educated. But what kind of personalities develop from a person who just doesn't have music in their life?
It's a good question. I'd love to hear from any listeners on this. Certainly the the data we were looking at and the papers we were reading, they seem, if anything, it seems like most of the time the researchers are surprised at how well the individual does, you know? Yeah. So it's I don't see a lot. It's maybe in the more severe cases where it's affecting, you know, greater sound agnosia general or other types of stimulus coming into the brain. But for the most part, it doesn't seem to handicap them significantly. I mean, they're still able, in many cases, to enjoy music, the thing, the one area that is specifically affected.
Yeah, I'm also wondering, too, and please, listeners, chime in on this one as well. With the rise in popularity of podcasts, I wonder if that is an outlet for amusiacs. Like, I don't like music, but these podcasts are great, so I'll just load up a bunch of these and listen to these all the time.
I've certainly met people like that, the people who don't want to drive with music on, and inevitably they want to listen to something.
Right.
And they'll go for a podcast, they'll go for a radio show, or
like
a book
an
on
audio
tape.
Book. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Huh. Well, I like to balance back and forth between the two. Sometimes I'm in the mood for music, sometimes I'm in the mood for a podcast or a book, but it's an interesting difference in experiences. Well, it seems like there's a lot of information that we can learn from you, the listeners out here, about this. I mean, we're scratching the surface of this pretty much brand new discipline of research. So let us know what you think about it. I want to hear your experiences. Maybe you've met people who don't like music at all. Maybe you're one of those people. Maybe that's why you listen to the show. So let us know. You can contact us in all the usual ways. We are on social media all over the place, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. And then there's also our landing page, stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you're going to find all the podcasts, all the videos we've made, and all of the articles, none of which are musical based. If you have amusia, you can consume them and be just fine.
That's right. And hey, if you want to get in touch with us directly, as always, email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Ever wolf down a Big Mac and thought, I need some extra cash? Then download the Drop app. Get rewarded for dining out and more. Use code DROP22 for $5 in points. Download Drop now.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like...
Whoa.
And...
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.